I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Yesterday, President Obama made a rare presidential appearance at the Capitol to push for his stimulus plan. Today, he's traveling to the Pentagon to get a status report on troop pullout in Iraq and troop increase in Afghanistan. Obama will hear from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who yesterday told Congress that civilian casualties in Afghanistan have to be stopped, saying if not, we are lost. Dimitri Sevastopoulou is Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dimitri, Gates also said yesterday that two new brigades of U.S. troops would head to Afghanistan by late spring. Now, first of all, by the way, how many troops is that?
That would be roughly about, it would be three brigades, and it would be roughly 12,000 troops.
Okay. Well, he also said he didn't think any more than the 30,000 troops, I think it is, that are slated for Afghanistan should then go to Afghanistan, because he said other countries have tried military dominance in Afghanistan before and it has failed. Is this something of a change? Because months ago we were hearing that Afghanistan needed a huge surge of ground troops to replace the helicopters that are mistakenly killing civilians. So is this a shift?
I don't think so. I mean, what Secretary Gates is saying is that commanders in Afghanistan have asked for 30,000 troops. Over the next few months, they're going to get the first 12,000 of those. Then at some point over probably the next year, depending on how quickly the U.S. withdraws from Iraq, commanders will get the remaining 18,000 troops. And what Gates is saying is after that, he doesn't think you should put any more in. What he wants to do is to focus on developing the Afghan army and putting Afghan soldiers in the lead in the fight, so that when there are civilian casualties, which inevitably will happen, it doesn't look like the U.S. is killing Afghans indiscriminately, even when it's by mistake.
Now, you say you were struck by what Defense Secretary Gates said about setting realistic goals in Afghanistan. Why? What did he say?
Well, for the last number of years, particularly the last year as the Bush administration started to shift more towards focusing on Afghanistan, the talk was still about democracy in Afghanistan and nation building. Gates lowered expectations yesterday. He said that he thought the main priority should be preventing Afghanistan from becoming a safe haven again where al-Qaeda or other militants and extremists could attack the U.S. He was talking less about democracy than the Bush administration and than when he was serving under the Bush administration.
So in other words, it may not be the government that the Bush administration might have liked, but it will be a government that will keep extremists from being based there.
Yeah, I think ultimately what he's saying is if you look at the reason why the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in the first place, it was because the 9/11 attacks were planned there and al-Qaeda was training there in its training camps. And what Gates is saying is that was the threat. That's the threat that needs to be eliminated. And so anything that the U.S. does in Afghanistan should be geared towards achieving that.
And is President Obama drawing any lines in the sand here? Where does he stand on the number of troops he wants to go to Afghanistan? And where do military leaders stand on Obama's original goal of a 16-month withdrawal from Iraq?
Well, when he goes to the Pentagon later today, he's going to be presented with plans to withdraw from Iraq. It's going to be a range of options looking at a 16-month plan to a plan that would reduce troops by the end of 2011, which is actually required by a recent security agreement between the U.S. and Iraq. He will then have to determine which of those plans he wants to put into place. And part of his consideration is going to be how quickly he wants to increase troops in Afghanistan. The more quickly troops come out of Iraq, the more quickly they can go into Afghanistan. But there is a trade-off there at the moment still.
And is there a sense that, you know, you say trade-off, is there a sense that the troops will leave Iraq, even if there are still voices who say that that's dangerous, that Iraq might collapse?
I think President Obama is probably going to stick to his 16-month timetable, more or less. There might be a little bit of leeway on either side. But I think what's more interesting is how he staggers the withdrawals. I mean, does he have a kind of a front-heavy withdrawal where a lot of troops leave this year the first 11 months of his administration or 12 months? Or does he have fewer withdrawals this year, and then the last 6 months of that 16-month period, does he have kind of a much larger withdrawal? Commanders in Iraq want it to be staggered. They want fewer withdrawals now and more later. But it's not clear exactly where President Obama is going to go.
And do we know when he is? I mean, is there a sense of when these decisions will be made public?
There's no concrete timetable, but I think the meeting today with the Joint Chiefs is very important, and I imagine that we will probably hear from him in the next couple of weeks, but I don't know specifically.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, we want to take a few minutes today to look at a forgotten chapter in American health care, the narcotic farm, a federal prison created in 1935 on 1,000 bucolic acres in Lexington, Kentucky. The inmates were all drug addicts, convicted criminals, and volunteers who committed themselves to receive treatment. In the beginning, there was a lot of hope. For a time, it was even a hip place to play jazz. Saxophone great Sonny Rollins was there and got sober. Trumpeter Chet Baker was there and did not. Many didn't get sober, and increasingly, the narco farm turned to research, with the convicted prisoners as voluntary guinea pigs, taking the very drugs they were supposed to be kicking.
There was this one guy who was high every day. They'd take him out of the main population for 2 or 3 weeks, and they tried different drugs on him.
Guys that were in there loved being there because it was a better way to do time than being in population. I mean, would you rather lay around in your pajamas and wait for some kind of dope to be shot into you or work on the farm?
Filmmaker J.P. Olson uses archival footage and modern-day interviews to tell the story of the narcotic farm in the PBS documentary of the same name. He joins us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Nancy Campbell. She's a drug historian from Rensselaer Polytech Institute in Troy, New York, also co-author of a companion book to the film, which is also called The Narcotic Farm. Nancy, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And we're going to hear also from a former inmate at the narcotic farm. But first, JP, these inmates were addicts that, as you say in the film, hospitals couldn't treat and prisons didn't want. Tell us more about them.
The institution saw more than 60,000 volunteers over the course of its 40-year history. So it's, you know, it's strange to think about now, but at the time you could basically walk up to the door and say, I am a drug addict, and they would let you in. And so basically at that time, you had to sign yourself into a prison to get treatment. And in many cases, volunteers came there because they really had nowhere else to go. And I heard story after story in my interviews of people saying they went to Lexington because they'd run out of options. The only option they had was to continue using, get arrested, or in a lot of cases, end up dead.
And Nancy, take us back to the 30s. This is before Narcanon. In fact, AA is just sort of growing at this point. Tell us how drug addicts were treated in society. How was their addiction dealt with?
Well, drug addiction had bedeviled the United States since the early 20th century, and in 1914 we had criminalized it through the Harrison Narcotic Act. What that meant was that by the late 1920s, there were a lot of drug addicts in prison, and in fact the prisons were overcrowded. About a third of the people there were there on federal drug charges.
And I'm guessing they got no treatment in prisons.
There was very little treatment in prisons, and in fact, in jails, people had to basically kick cold turkey, and many, many doctors refused to treat them at all. So the only place that they could go to get medical treatment or even dental care was Lexington.
And Lexington became so renowned, it was featured in the 1955 film The Man with the Golden Arm, of course starring Frank Sinatra as an addict who was treated there. You have this in your film. Let's listen.
It's Dr. Lennox who took care of me down at the hospital. Real good guy. He told me at least 10 times, he said, Frankie, when you get out of here, you take even one fix, you're hooked again.
Well, that film, The Man with the Golden Arm, with Frank Sinatra, and JP, subsequently your documentary, they both show us just the ugly, monstrous nature of addiction, because doctors at Lexington use something called talk therapy. They use what they called moral therapy, group therapy. They really have such great hopes that they can knock back these addictions, but it becomes very, very difficult, doesn't it, JP?
Well, I think that's right. I think early on in the, you know, the beginnings of the institution, there was a lot of hope that therapy and that talk therapy was going to get at the root of the problem of anyone who'd become addicted, because clearly if you become a heroin addict, your life is not going particularly well. And so there was this sense that we can somehow, through psychotherapy, figure out what is this person's problem. But what they found was that talk therapy wasn't all that effective. People would leave the institution feeling pretty good, and within a very short period of time, they would relapse. That dynamic dogged the institution basically for the life of the institution.
Right. Let's bring someone else into the conversation now. Bernie Kolb was one of those volunteers for treatment at the narcotics farm. In 1964, he stayed for 1 year and worked as a researcher's assistant in the prison's research lab. Bernie, you know, we hear in the film former inmates and addicts saying that the addicts would scam the doctors. It was just the nature of the disease. They'd go to group therapy and lie.
Is that true? You knew that?
There's no question about it. You said what people wanted to hear. An addict rarely told the truth. I didn't tell the truth in any kind of group therapy until much later when I was truly clean and trying to clean up my act.
So doctors became frustrated, and the facility shifts more to experiments and research to find out why. You know, they opened the Addiction Research Center, known as the ARC. The inmates were willing guinea pigs. Nancy, as an historian, how do you view this?
As a historian, it's my job to carefully sift through evidence and to undo some of the myths that became conventional wisdom. In fact, I think we thought we had stumbled upon another horror story like the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male. And we just did not find that. In fact, we found something very different. We found doctors and researchers who were really sincerely and compassionately trying to understand what addiction was.
But despite those good intentions, the research also began to, in some ways, through the eyes of some inmates, backfire, because we are, again, in the story dealing with addicts. Let's listen to what some of the inmates had to say about the research.
People would come up out of that lab talking about when they went through the withdrawal, how terrible it was. And in spite of that, everybody was willing to go down there because it meant getting drunk.
Bernie, your thoughts on what some people might find, you know, a little difficult to understand. These were addicts who, yes, they were volunteering to do research, but they were getting drugs while they were doing the research. So, you know, we're grappling with, were there ethical questions about that? Were there ethical questions at the time, or have you had any later?
No, the only ones who had ethical questions would be the doctors, and they were there to do the research, so that was their primary goal.
What did you think about the experiments?
Since I was a volunteer, I couldn't do drugs while I was there. You had to be doing at least 10 years. But they asked me to work on the research ward, and I did. And I, what I remember about the experiments was I was jealous.
You were jealous?
I was jealous. These guys were, they actually had a window on the research ward where you could stick your arm in if you had drugs coming and present your identification and get what you wanted, get some morphine.
That's Bernie Kolb. He volunteered, as he said, for addiction treatment at the federal prison, the Narcotic Farm, back in 1964. We've also been speaking with filmmaker J.P. Olson, drug historian Nancy Campbell, about the Narcotic Farm. And as we mentioned, it became a mecca for jazz musicians. Some even checked themselves in just to play with the masters who were getting treatment there. Musicians like Sonny Rollins, Lee Morgan, Elvin Jones, and Chet Baker. We're listening to Chet Baker's rendition of All Blues right now, and anyone who knows his story knows that the treatment there did not work. Well, we're going to hear more about the ethical questions about the Narcotic Farm in a moment. Later today, Bolivia's Indians are getting a lot of power, or at least more power, after centuries of oppression. So why has the U.S. been sitting on the sideline in that region? That's later. We'll be back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back, and we're taking a look back at the Narcotic Farm, a prison set up in the 1930s to treat addicts. Bernie Kolb sought treatment there back in the 60s. He was a volunteer. Also with us is J.P. Olson, director of the film The Narcotic Farm, and Nancy Campbell, a drug historian. And Nancy, as we were saying, the facility was open for 40 years. It went from primarily treating addiction to researching the causes of addiction. And the prisoners who were convicted could take part in that research. And critics have said, of course, addicts will volunteer for research experiments if that meant getting drugs.
Yes, indeed. They actually did not re-addict people who were seeking treatment. People who voluntarily sought treatment were not allowed to participate in experiments. Only convicts who were already in the federal system and who had expressed no desire to quit using drugs ever participated in research. And that no desire to quit using drugs is an important thing. We're talking about long-term addicts who themselves were considered themselves to be poor treatment prospects. In other words, they were seasoned addicts who knew full well what they were getting into, and they were actually motivated at some level by the promise of drugs.
Not only the promise of drugs during the experiments, but do we understand, JP, that some of the inmates were also given drugs that they could bank for another time?
That's right. The drug bank was in operation for about 20 years. And, you know, it seems bad because you're rewarding behavior that's probably not helpful to a person's rehabilitation. And I think that's pretty obvious. But at the same time, for the researchers, they didn't see it as a big deal because there was no imminent danger of overdose or addiction with this drug payment because the amounts were small.
Well, and Nancy, I'm wondering, too, compared to what was available to them in other jails, this might have been more compassionate treatment for them.
Yeah, if you think about maintenance, which was not something that was done at Lexington. At Lexington, there was no methadone maintenance. Methadone was used after 1948 as a detox agent, so it was there to basically cushion the blows of your withdrawal. So indeed, you can look at this and you can say that there was something somewhat compassionate, in fact, because the big goal of all of the research at Lexington was actually to find a cure for drug addiction or also to prevent drug addiction by finding a non-addictive painkiller.
But still, there were inmates who later began to feel that something wasn't quite right with there being part of experiments. And Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts launched congressional hearings. You have these in your film, JP. This is in 1975, mm-hmm. looking into the human testing of narcotics at Lexington. And Senator Kennedy spoke to several of them, including former inmate Ed Flowers. Let's listen.
The payoff not only was in drugs, but it was also in time. They had a choice of earning days on the time that you were doing there, or you could get paid off in narcotics. I choose narcotics.
What did most of the other patients choose, narcotics or time off?
The majority of them choose narcotics.
I'll be very honest with you. It wasn't until we had the hearings that I began to come to grips with the fact that, you know, I was used. And things that were said there in that hearing kind of like brought it home to me.
Nancy, so now we hear this after, you know, thinking that perhaps this was more compassion. If you have a drug addict in jail, maybe give them a little bit of drugs. You hear that, and first of all, you have Ed, who's prominent in the film, saying that, you know, he felt he was used. But also you realize, what choice do the inmates have? I mean, if you're an addict, do you really have a choice? If you understand that if you do the research, you're going to get either time off or drugs.
Well, that's a great question. The scientists at the ARC basically saw themselves as protecting the public health. They saw themselves as guarding against another heroin ever going on the market. And in fact, they were doing research that they thought was going to end up benefiting all addicts.
Bernie, how do you feel it worked for addicts?
Well, you mentioned earlier that it was the only place people could go and get humane treatment, and that's the truth. I kicked in prisons, I kicked in jails. In fact, I kicked on a cement floor in Myrtle Beach, California, just prior to going to Lexington.
Do you mean kick the habits?
Kick the habit, a long-standing habit. I was getting drugstore stuff. I forget what they called it, but I used to boil it down and shoot it. And it was terrible stuff. It ruined my veins. To this day, I can't get good hospital treatment at the VA because they can't find a vein, and they have to go in through my arteries. So by the time I got to Lexington, I just wanted drugs, and if I couldn't get drugs, then I wanted to get off. So I went there thinking, all right, maybe I can get away from drugs.
Did you get off after Lexington, or did you go back to drugs?
I've been back off and on, but for very short periods. And I went to California, and I got myself completely away from drugs for the next 20 years.
What do you think the overarching legacy of the narcotic farm is? Nancy, you first.
Well, I think the knowledge base that came out of the ARC is very, very important. We learned how to reverse overdose and save people's lives. We learned how to use methadone to medically assist detox. We know that conditioning plays a role in relapse. We know that some effects of addiction last for months and even years after people stop using opiates. We know a lot of things that we did not know before the Addiction Research Center, and that is worth having.
And JP, you note that in the end, 90% of Lexington's patients went back to using drugs and almost immediately after their release. So what is your final footnote? Was the narcotic farm a failure in that sense?
You know, the failure rate was something like 90%. 90% of the people who left went back to drugs right away. But, you know, my feeling is it did save people's lives during the time that they were there. I think that that gets lost in this conversation because people want results. But the fact that it kept many people alive over the years is something that is really important to remember.
Bernie, your thoughts of the benefit of the narcotic farm?
The benefits to me are very obvious. I'm 75 years old and I'm alive. I don't have any friends who I use drugs with who are still alive or not in prison.
That's Bernie Kolb, a volunteer inmate at the Lexington, Kentucky Narcotic Farm in 1964. We've also been speaking with J.P. Olson. He's director of The Narcotic Farm, a documentary airing on PBS stations. And Nancy Campbell, she and J.P. were two of the co-authors of a companion book to the film. It's called The Narcotic Farm. I want to thank you all three of you, for speaking to us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, still ahead today. Some school kids still haven't forgiven him. We'll speak to the scientist who helped downgrade Pluto here and now. When Evo Morales was elected president of Bolivia in 2006, he was the first indigenous person to head that country since the Spanish conquest nearly 500 years ago. The left-leaning union organizer with close ties to Bolivia's indigenous coca farmers worried many in Bolivia and outside of it, including the Bush administration. But this week, Bolivia's native peoples are celebrating another victory, a sweeping new constitution designed to empower the country's Indians, who half a century ago weren't even allowed in the main square of the nation's capital. Supporters compare this vote to Barack Obama's election in the U.S. Detractors of the new constitution see it as a power grab by President Morales. Well, indigenous peoples have been gaining power recently in many parts of South America, along with left-leaning, democratically elected leaders. So let's take a closer look today with Adam Isaacson, Latin American expert at the Center for International Policy. Adam, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with the Bolivian Constitution. One of the primary criticisms is that it has 411 articles. It recognizes 36 different indigenous groups, some with less than 100 people. A new Congress is going to have to work all of this out. But what are the basic provisions?
The basic provisions are some of the ones you mentioned. It does give much more broader rights to indigenous communities and more autonomy to those communities. They can even now have sort of a parallel justice system for trying criminal cases. They're going to have a quota of seats in the new Congress. There's also economic provisions. There's greater state control over things like Bolivia's natural gas. They've got the largest natural gas reserves in South America and could actually be a much wealthier country. The president, Evo Morales, now has the right to run for one more re-election. And in fact, he may be able to run for election now under the new constitution and stay for as much as 10 years after that.
Mm-hmm. What does the new constitution say about land ownership? Because there was concern.
It looks like there will be no expropriation of the large landowners who are pretty much largely in the eastern part of the country. They're not going to see that lose their lands. But from now on, no new land holdings could be more than about 12,000 acres, 5,000 hectares.
Well, and though there's not going to be any land seizure now, this is a country divided. Four regions in the east of Bolivia remain opposed to the
That's
president
right.
and the constitution. And these provinces also have the lion's share of the country's fossil fuel deposits. So where do you think Bolivia's headed? Because there's been talk of Bolivia splitting.
Yeah, and that talk is going to continue because the people in that eastern half of the country, which is wealthier and which is far less indigenous, are unhappy. The refusal vote of the Constitution won overwhelmingly in the eastern part of the country, and people have already taken to the streets to protest the outcome. And Bolivia, I mean, there are several countries in Latin America where there is a large indigenous population, more than 30%. You've got Mexico, Guatemala, Peru, but Bolivia also has really a geographic overlap. The other countries sort of scatter the indigenous population around more evenly, whereas Bolivia, you really do have a geographical, more Balkan-style east-west divide, with some exceptions like the capital, La Paz. But that could play out in a very difficult way if President Morales is not, you know, continues to use divisive rhetoric and continues to make that non-indigenous royalty or minority feel like they are somehow left out, and there will be a greater push for autonomy.
Well, and so where does the U.S. stand on all of this? You say divisive language. Some are saying that the passage of this new constitution is comparable to Barack Obama's victory. It sounds more comparable to Lyndon Johnson's passage of landmark civil rights legislation. But we're not hearing a lot of cheering coming from the U.S.
Well, President Morales is not a fan of the United States. He politically is close to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and Fidel Castro in Cuba, although certainly not as authoritarian as either. And he is often a frequent and harsh critic of the United States, especially during the Bush years. Now, President Obama, I would add there that just suspicions over USAID's programs under the Bush administration in Bolivia led President Morales even to eject the ambassador in September. Now, the Obama administration obviously has something of a clean slate. The State Department the other day said they welcomed the outcome of the voting over the weekend, and President Morales responded that he found that encouraging. That's great. But, President Obama has a choice in Bolivia. You've got the indigenous, historically excluded, poor majority that just got elected, has come to power through electoral means for the first time, but is also quite anti-American and very suspicious of the U.S. motives. And then you have the non-indigenous, wealthier minority, which does have a history of corruption and inequality, but is also very pro-free market and very pro-U.S.
This is, you've said to us, this is part of this kind of uncomfortable shift in the region. It's emerging from decades of right-wing dictatorships, but they were U.S.-friendly.
That's right. 30 years ago, almost every country in Latin America was under some sort of military or otherwise dictatorship, and they've gone through this transition to democracy. And for the first 10 or 15 years of voting, voters were pretty cautious, voting for very establishment candidates, people who had the favor of the military. But they've gotten bolder, and they've gotten bolder at a time when U.S. influence in the region was also retreating, especially during the Bush years. And they voted for presidents who look more like them. This is, almost all of these countries have poverty rates over 50%, and they have people with darker skin or indigenous populations, and they've started to vote for candidates who represent them better. And unfortunately, a lot of those candidates and now presidents have very anti-U.S. views.
Well, and as a result, these countries are forging closer ties with both China and Russia. Latin American leaders recently held a summit in Brazil, and the U.S. wasn't even invited. It was highly criticized. Venezuela and Russia conducted joint military exercises. Defense Secretary Gates was asked about that this week in Congress. What did he say?
He had an interesting response. He said that that the exercises themselves didn't really worry him, that at $40 a barrel oil prices, he didn't see Russia as much of a threat, and that, in fact, had Russia not invaded Georgia in August, he would have been happy to have invited the Russians to pay a port call in Miami and do some shopping. He said, though, also that the relationship that does worry him in the region much more than Russia or China is Iran, who President Ahmadinejad has paid visits to Caracas and, I believe, to La Paz as well in the last year, and there was more investment and sort of joint ventures, things that look innocuous but certainly have the U.S. intelligence community worried.
Well, and given also that Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, for example, has been buffeted by falling oil prices, he's been courting Western oil companies again after nationalizing their oil fields, so he might, be a candidate for turning to Iran.
He may be, although Iran is going to be facing the same limitations with oil being one of their main sources of revenue as well. Chavez 2 years ago was giving more aid to the rest of the region than the United States was. He may still be, but it's sharply reduced this year.
Adam Isaacson, Latin American expert at the Center for International Policy. By the way, to get to Adam's blog on South America, go to our website here-now.org. Adam, thanks so much for this snapshot.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Okay. And just a reminder, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, or you can download a podcast, take us with you. That's here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. U.S. really isn't known as a country where, like Bolivia, you can bargain or haggle over purchases. But maybe that's changing here as stores get more desperate. And our next guest says, go ahead, try striking a bargain for your medical bills, your haircut, your groceries. Jeff Yeager is author of The Ultimate Cheapskake's Roadmap to True Riches, a practical and fun guide to enjoying life more by spending less. Jeff, you say it never hurts to ask, but these days medical bills are decided by insurance companies. Prices are set by, you know, the owner of a box store that you're never going to get to meet and haggle with. So how do you do this? Let's start with medical bills.
I found a couple of people who had success in negotiating lower medical fees. These were normally people who weren't covered by insurance, who basically told their doctors that they weren't covered by insurance and asked their doctors, would they accept what the doctor would be reimbursed from the insurance company? You know, a lot of times doctors, what they get reimbursed from the insurance company is less than their sort of rack rate for a procedure. So a lot of times this was a successful negotiating strategy.
Well, what about bank fees? I mean, you know, banks are hurting. Are they really going to waive fees?
You know, banking is, of course, such an incredibly competitive enterprise. And time again, the people I spoke to said they had been successful in getting, you know, all kinds of routine stop payment fees on checks and that kind of thing waived simply by asking the bank teller. You don't even sometimes have to go to the manager.
Well, you write about all this in the current edition of the AARP magazine. You say rule number three is repeat after me, never, ever pay the advertised price for consumer electronics.
Yeah, it's probably the easiest pickings. Particularly the big box electronics stores are, again, so competitive that if you simply go in, talk to the salesperson, ask them, you know, nicely if they can do any better on the price, and then suggest that you're going to shop the competition, many times that's all it takes in order for them to give you a lower price.
Well, and if you offer to pay cash, does that really get people to lower prices of things?
It certainly can. I think you'd be more, of course, the rationale being that if you charge it, the merchant has a merchant processing fee on the charged transaction. That seems to be more successful with a mom-and-pop outfit.
Right.
But certainly give it a try. Show them the money. Show them the cash.
And lastly, subscriptions and insurance premiums, other things to bargain down. How do you do that?
Yeah, I call my insurance company every year on April 1st. That's because I ain't no fool day. And I ask them, you know, let's talk about my package coverage. Maybe there's a new discount that I'm eligible for that, of course, they didn't bother to apply to the account. So it never hurts to ask. And something like magazine subscriptions are very negotiable in many instances. Of course, magazines depend on having a large readership so they can charge advertisers more for their ads. So that magazine really needs you as a subscriber. So when it comes time to renew or take out a new subscription, ask if there's not some special promotion or discount that they can give you.
And you say timing's everything. You hire businesses when their services aren't in demand. Great examples. Make a midweek appointment with your auto mechanic. Hire a tree care service to trim your trees in the winter. Ask your accountant for a break on fees. In exchange, offer to file for an extension on your taxes. That gives your accountant a break in April when they're backed up.
Yeah, get your chimneys cleaned in the summertime and your lawnmower repaired in the wintertime.
Okay, will do. But you also say, just in general, live on less. You spent more than two decades as a senior executive with a national nonprofit organization, and you now write about how to live spending less. That's the topic of your book. You know, some of it makes sense. Don't live beyond your means. Try to fiscal fast, not spend any money for 1 week.
Yeah, it's sort of a spending detox. It's the week where we'll finally uncork those little bottles of shampoo we've been saving from the Motel 6. And it's going to show you how you spend and probably waste money in a typical week. And it's going to remind us all there's so many terrific things in life that don't involve spending money.
Okay, and also forget the latte factor. Don't try to save by skipping coffee, but really focus on the big expenses.
Yeah, you know, my contention is if you make even one or two fundamental financial decisions correct in your life, the big ones like where you live, what you eat, what kind of transportation you rely on, and that really reshapes your relationship with money throughout your life. For instance, my theory on housing has always been finish in your starter home. Buy a modest home when you're starting out. Pay it off just as quickly as you can, and then get on with enjoying life.
Jeff Yeager, The Ultimate Cheapskate. His book is called The Ultimate Cheapskate's Roadmap to True Riches, a practical and fun guide to enjoying life more by spending less. And also we'll link you to his article in the AARP magazine about bargaining. Jeff, thanks so much.
Robin, stay cheap.
Okay. Well, it's still a sore subject for some, but we'll be back in a minute with the man who helped demote Pluto, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back.
In Arizona at the turn of the century, astromathematician Percival Lowell was searching for what he called Planet X, 'cause he knew deep down in his soul.
Its mass is 70% rock, 30% ice. It's been celebrated in story and song. That's Christine Lavin's Planet X. It's a cartoon. Think Mickey Mouse's Bloodhound. It's even a storyline. Here's Aaron Sorkin's late 1990s comedy Sports Night.
We've got the suns moving in Phoenix, hurricanes in Miami, but guess what? Pluto's still a planet.
Wishful thinking, but Pluto isn't a planet. And astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson learned what a following Pluto had when, as the head of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, he became the center of the storm over Pluto's demotion from planet status. Neil deGrasse Tyson writes about that time and everything you ever wanted to know about Pluto in his new book, The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet. And he joins us from his office at the American Museum of Natural History. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what is Pluto?
It's a cosmic object.
Okay.
a cosmic object in the outer solar system that of late has found other icy brethren to keep it company.
And is everyone on board with this now? Because throughout the book, you tell us about an ongoing debate that you had with Mark Sykes, who you say is Pluto's pit bull, you know, Pluto's biggest defender. And it seems that the last encounter was in 2008 in August when you were at a panel, and it was moderated by NPR's Ira Flatow. You entered the auditorium, the two of you, with Let's Get Ready to Rumble music, you know, big deal. But is he on board? Are the detractors of the non-planet theory all on board?
There's no one who's unsure that Pluto has family out there. That's kind of understood. A lot of the emotion was flying back and forth based on whether Pluto would retain the classification status of planet.
Right. Well, let's review the history here. Clyde Tombaugh discovered Planet X in 30. It was named Pluto after the god of the underworld. But it always had some unusual characteristics, as you said, that sort of had scientists questioning it. Why? What were those?
Oh, yeah, the characteristics are manifest. First, its orbit is so odd that it crosses the orbit of another planet. It crosses the orbit of Neptune. No other planet does that. You announced at the beginning of this broadcast that it's 70% rock. However, if you look at the volume, because rock is heavier than ice, it's more than half ice by volume. An object like that, if you brought it, for example, to where Earth is, the sunlight would evaporate that ice, and it would grow a tail.
Hmm. Now, and be a comet.
That's no kind of behavior for a planet, and we got words for things with tails. And not only that, its orbit is tipped heavily out of the plane of the rest of the orbits of the planets. And so it's an oddball, no matter how you slice it.
Right. Well, you were appointed head of the Hayden Planetarium and also appointed project scientist for the Rose Center for Earth and Space. And one of the big questions people there were grappling with was how to classify planets. So you pulled together a conference on Pluto's planethood. Some of these questions were expressed. It was determined that Pluto was an object in the Kuiper Belt.
Yeah. There's a guy, Gerard Kuiper, at mid-20th century, who hypothesized that there'd be this reservoir of icy bodies in the outer solar system left over from the formation of the solar system. And Pluto, turns out, is a prominent member of the Kuiper Belt.
So that's the family that it's now in. And the planetarium goes ahead and puts together an exhibit classifying Pluto with, you know, other objects like it, not with the planets. And everything is fine until a New York Times reporter is visiting and overhears a child ask, "Where's Pluto?"
The reporter who overheard this figured he had, like, a real scoop. He contacted the science reporter, who returned and actually wrote the story, which hit page one of the New York Times.
We all remember.
Page one.
And Neil, you are accused of eliminating Pluto. It's front page news. There's stories everywhere. Now, we're reminded, you said, you know, one of the problems with categorizing Pluto as a planet is that you'd have to consider other objects' planets as well, including Pluto's moon, Charon, and Ceres. And you end up on the Stephen Colbert show. This is how crazy this is getting. And poke fun at that. Let's listen.
"Hey, Charon, your orbit is so big you only get Christmas once every 248 years. Even then, all you get is earmuffs because it's so cold. Snap!"
All right, we got Ceres. Let's go to Ceres right here. Tell me about Ceres.
That's object formerly known as an asteroid. Mm-hmm. It happens to be big enough so that its gravity tucked it into a nice round shape.
All right, have a good look. I got it. Hey, Ceres, guess what? They call you a planet, but we both know you're just a fat-ass steroid. Yeah, you're so ugly, God tried to hide you in an asteroid belt.
Neil, you're a serious scientist. do you believe the wild ride you went on?
It was extraordinary. One could be disturbed by it, but another outlook of it would be to celebrate the fact that there was a scientific controversy that so thoroughly engaged the public. Kids and journalists and old people and young people, and everyone chose sides. It's as though everyone had some investment in the answer to that question.
Well, legislatures in New Mexico and California proposed declaring Pluto to still be a planet. And you know, people really did care. You got a lot of hate mail.
One of my favorites is, "Dear Dr. Tyson, you took out my favorite planet. Please put it back. Here's a drawing of it." And there it is in crayon. It says, "Write back soon, but not in cursive. I can't read cursive yet."
That same child writes, "If you make Pluto a planet again, the science books will be right."
That's right.
But if you say it's not a planet, what if people live there? They won't exist. a point.
Yeah, people over assessing the actual power we have over the cosmos.
But it did get very heated. I mentioned Mark Sykes. They had some very heated conversations with, you know, people within the science community who were very upset about this. Why the passion?
Right. So it wasn't just the public or the school kids. There was the professional community as well, many of whom studied Pluto as a cosmic object felt very strongly that Pluto should retain planet status. I had no investment one way or another, but I can tell you this, that in the end, I really don't care how you define the word planet. I just know that if the way you define it, it includes huge, bulbous, gaseous planets with small, dense ones, that if Pluto is in the same class as Jupiter, and the word planet is the word you're using, then the word planet has kind of lost most of its utility.
Well, Pluto is still there and may be there well beyond us.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
It's not that anything changed about Pluto. It's something changed about our understanding of the structure of the solar system. And so while I was sort of the most visible exponent of this movement from 2000 on through 2006, in 2006, the professional community brought it to vote and basically agreed with our sentiment. And so Pluto gets demoted. So now there are only 8 planets, and Pluto is now the benchmark class of a new kind of object called Plutoids. And so it's fine. I don't have a problem with these definitions.
Well, just take a quick look ahead for us. You know, I want to ask you what you think we don't know. You know, what else do you think? I mean, do you see something on the horizon, literally, that might change the way we think about something?
Well, about Pluto, I can tell you that there's a mission en route to Pluto right now, and it's going to swing by Pluto and look at other objects in the Kuiper Belt. What that will do is bring a whole new understanding of the properties of objects that are out there. It's a new swath of real estate, sort of born in the 1990s into our awareness as we started discovering these other icy bodies in the outer solar system. So when I think of the Pluto story, I don't think of it as we lost a planet. We gained a whole new place in the solar system. People should embrace that kind of discovery.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, his book is The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet. Neil, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
They invented a reason, and that's why it stings. They don't think you matter because you don't have pretty rings. I keep telling you I don't care. I keep saying there's one. The rest of the world looks so small.